Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture, with me, Owen Wainhouse.
Architects see the planners as being kind of reductive, and planners see the architects as dreamers, and actually we're all trying to do the same thing. And I'm sure some planners look at me and they're like, she's not really a planner, is she? Architects look at me and say, she's not really an architect. But, you know, I'm used to that. I moved country. I don't really fit in anywhere. I think that's a positive. Yeah. I think that kind of multidisciplinary aspect is something we should encourage and celebrate rather than be very precious about our professions. I'm Pooja Agrawal. I'm the co-founder of Public Practice and I work in the GLA Regeneration team.
You're listening to Architecture Masters with me, Owen Wainhouse. On the programme this week is the architect Pooja Agrawal. In 2017, Pooja co-founded the social enterprise Public Practice along with Finn Williams. In the 1970s, almost half of UK architects leaving university went on to work for the public sector. But throughout the 1980s, central government effectively stifled local government's ability to build, and that architectural expertise began to drain away. Today, the proportion of architects working for the public sector in London is, according to Public Practice, well under 1% of the profession. Public Practice, the organisation that Finn and Pooja created, places architects and other built environment experts within local authorities on year-long placements, providing much-needed skills and expertise for the public sector. Perhaps Public Practice can make public service and working for the public sector an attractive option again for ambitious architects. And the signs are positive. Pioneering London boroughs like Croydon, Barking and Dagenham and Harrow are starting to build again, and well-designed buildings too. Pooja was born in Ohio in the United States before moving with her family back to their home in Mumbai in India. It was from Mumbai that she later moved to the UK to continue her education, studying for a degree in architecture at the University of Cambridge before going on to do her MA at the Bartlett School of Architecture in London. She went on to work for a number of practices that put public sector work front and centre, working initially for Publica and then We Made That, where she worked on projects including the regeneration of Black Horse Lane and Walthamstow. In addition to her work at Public Practice, Pooja also works at the regeneration team at the Greater London Authority. I started by asking Pooja about her route from architecture to planning and regeneration.
I trained as an architect, and I guess I was always sort of interested in everything beyond the building. And all through my education, I was interested in the places the buildings we were designing were, and often got told off for doing that. So I've always worked in practices or tried to seek out practices that were kind of sort of thinking about places beyond buildings. And over the years, basically found myself working for practices that whose clients were the public sector, and that the sort of social good that architecture can have was also another really important sort of agenda for me. Right. So I kind of always wanted to work on public buildings and also work on projects that had sort of wider impact. And like I said, sort of found the public sector being my client for a number of projects. Mm. And it's sort of the penny dropped at some point when I thought, actually, if I was on the other side of the table, I would be able to have a much bigger impact because I'll be actually be making the decision about what the project is rather than being told this is what the brief is and this is what you need to design. So that kind of wider, the almost the political, the social, the economic aspects of architecture kind of coming together and influencing that is what sort of attracted me to work in the public sector in the first place. So I joined the Greater London Authority just under it's been about 2.5 years. Okay. And that sort of jump from private sector to public sector is probably at that time wasn't that common. And within the sort of first 6 months, there's so many different things you have to get your head around. Actually, like, the politics is the biggest thing to get your head around, is like how...
Internal politics or kind of...
Internal, but also external politics, like how decisions are made. How do you determine how much money should go against a project, or who decides, who is the final person
who's saying lies.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So that was a really, really interesting sort of world to sort of get your head around, to things like procurement. Yeah. You know, a lot of these systems are in place to ensure fairness. Yeah. And yet, from the other side, having been the architect, going through bidding processes, you could think, oh my God, this is so tedious.
Yeah.
But suddenly being on the other side, you're like, oh wow, there's a bigger kind of legal and political framework for why these things exist. So my first 6 months was very much sort of like understanding the difference between the private sector and public sector. And when I joined the Greater London Authority, I met Finn Williams, who basically...
That was where the two of you met, was it?
So that's the first time we worked together. Right. And he had been working in the public sector for about sort of 7 or 8 years, and worked in Croydon Council and under the placemaking team that was led by Vincent Lacovara, who was another architect who joined public sector. And there was a number of people like Eleanor Fawcett, who now works in the Old Oak Park Royal Development Corporation, Beth Kay, who works in Haringey, who also trained as an architect. So there was, you know, a couple of these sort of role models floating around. And there was this idea of actually, if there was more people like us who joined public sector, like, you know, we'd be able to make a much bigger impact in terms of sort of influencing places from the client side of things. So the idea of public practice was sort of in Finn's head for a number of years. Right. And when I joined the GLA, we sort of had a conversation about it and thought, actually, let's do it. Let's just actually get this going. So we had spent some time actually gathering the right evidence to actually show, you know, the big thing really is about public sector capacity and realizing that local authorities actually really struggle to get the right people. And they have brilliant people already, but it's actually the kind of range of skills that they sort of really struggle to attract.
And is that... is that a thing now in terms of spending, or has that been a longer term kind of problem? I mean, people think about austerity and about local authorities being under such pressure.
Completely.
But has that been going on for a while, or is it, you know?
I think there's kind of two aspects to it. I think, you know, there's the kind of nostalgic, you know, the 70s and the 60s when local authority architects were sort of delivering, you know, housing, the National Theatre, and all these huge, amazing cultural and like projects and social infrastructure. Yeah. And obviously, through the years of austerity, through Thatcher, through the shrinking of the state, a lot of capacity has definitely shrunk, you know. And there's a bigger kind of structural idea of what the public sector is, and the public sector became service providers, I think, in the last sort of 5 to 10 years. And alongside that, I guess it became seen as not an ambitious place to work. Yeah. So when you look back to the 70s, you know, all architects wanted, from the AA, they all wanted to work in public sector. And when I was in university, I didn't even think of that as an option. You know, the idea that I'd work in the GLA, I didn't know if I even knew what the GLA was. So I think that as a sort of career choice, a career option,
just wasn't
on the table. Yeah. And partly because it was just not seen as an ambitious route.
Yeah.
And I grew up in India, and the, you know, government in India is like the heart of corruption. Yeah. And, you know, people go into government with this perception of, A, you have a job for life, B, you know, you're going to make money on the side. Yeah. And so there's a certain, you know, again, there's a cliche of people who join the public sector.
Right.
And when I told my dad I was going to join the GLA, I think he had a heart attack.
Start crying.
Basically saying, is that an ambitious career choice?
Yeah.
So that, there's definitely, I think the perception of working in public sector is something that public practice is really changing and has changed already in the last year.
Yeah.
And your sort of question around the kind of funding, yes, funding is a problem for local authorities, but amazingly, even with funding, they can find funding for people, but they still really struggle to find the right people.
And the talent and getting that.
Exactly.
And the interesting thing then, you've decided that public practice would be a not-for-profit company, but outside of the GLA, rather than trying to persuade the higher powers within the GLA to kind of to do that within the GLA. I just, that's an interesting model, you know, an approach, and that's presumably because you can get the best of both worlds. You can be quick, you can be nimble, you can kind of get these things set up.
Absolutely.
And,
I mean,
and was that a conscious decision?
Did completely. You think, it was a very, very conscious decision not to be within the GLA. Firstly, the GLA is about London, and we have got bigger ambitions. Okay. The idea is to go national, and we're already talking to different regions in the UK. And the other thing is really public practice is about building capacity of local authorities. So we are embedding what we call the associates into local authorities. And the idea of them being somehow linked to the GLA would always feel like it was a GLA scheme. Yeah. But actually, for us, it's about the local authorities having that embedded capacity and embedded strength. So spinning it out was, I mean, we had a business plan, we looked at multiple different options, and but even the local government association and the East of England LGA were our helped fund the business plan, so it was it was always part of the plan
to be national
exactly. And you know, it's a problem in London, it's a bigger problem across the country, and actually internationally we've had a lot of interest as well. Amazingly, we've had people, government officials from Egypt to like Sweden asking us, can you set this up here? We're like, let's go. let's
in
a couple
time.
Of years.
Okay. So the idea then is a kind of, you know, for people, I can't imagine there's many people, but people who are unfamiliar with public practice, the idea is the associates are generally trained architects?
No, it's not just about architecture, actually. So the idea is to basically attract talented built environment professionals. So that's architecture and planning in its broader sense. And also, you know, we're seeing a really big shift of what local authorities will be doing in the next few years, and direct delivery of homes is becoming a huge thing. So actually, the skills required for planning have changed, and that kind of economic understanding, viability, you know, surveying, all of these skills are skills we want to bring back into local government. So public practice is about attracting all of these different types of skills and talents and bringing them into local government.
And they're short periods, they're secondments a lot of the time, are they?
So it's a one-year placement, and the idea is that they are employed directly by the local authorities, and that's exactly about them being embedded. And they spend 90% of their time in the local authority, and then 10% of their time as a cohort doing a kind of research and development
with their
program.
Colleagues, with other people.
With the cohort of public practice, and we oversee their research and development program. So we initially they have a kind of 1 week intensive course, and you know, and I was talking about my first 6 months of getting my head around the politics and procurement. We've sort of squished that into a like really intensive 1 week here, associates, this is everything you need to know about public sector. And and then over the year, every other Friday we have seminars, we have talks, we invite people in, and initially public practice programs that, but over time the associates take ownership of that, and each of them are instigating a piece of research which is really pressing issues to do with their local authorities, and that research is really, really practical outputs and outcomes that is shared across government and local authorities. So it's almost like a think tank in some ways, but a really practical outputs, because really it's research through practice, because they're doing this every day as part of their jobs, and really saying, actually, this is something that doesn't quite work, how can we sort of change it, do this little thing we're doing, you know, and having a kind of bigger impact.
And that kind of 1 year, I mean, I guess a lot of private sector jobs are, you know, increasingly young people taking on kind of short-term contracts and kind of thinking on project by project basis almost. There's a thing of possibly about focusing the mind there and getting people to make an impact in a and leave a legacy behind when they go.
Completely. I think it's quite interesting that you sort of noticed that, because I mean the 1 year placement is a way for people to get their foot in. Yeah. And, you know, the opportunity is there after the year for the local authority to employ them full time. We don't take any cuts. That's, you know, that's the kind of pipeline. We just want to get people in. And hopefully that works out for the associate, but for the local authority as well, or we can find another opportunity for the associates. But the 1 year also is, it's the right amount of time for people to test something. I think if it was 3 years, people would be a bit more nervous about changing jobs or kind of making this what is seen as a big dive into a different type of working. And that kind of gives the right amount of like time just to test something out. And like you said, I think people think about jobs and working very differently now than they did, you know, 20 years ago in terms of, you know, I've worked at probably five different practices before I joined the GLA. And, you know, that's seen as a strength that you kind of learn from different places and, you know, you share that knowledge where you go. And I think it's a kind of strength that you can sort of move in and out of public sector, and that's not seen as a barrier as it being a job for life.
That's really So then I'm interested actually in the cohort. I mean, pretty astonishing, 200 applications for that first year. And I guess, you know, it's one thing when there's a track record and people kind of, there's a first year through and you kind of know, I think about the London School of Architecture, you know, people going into the first year, there's a kind of a boldness, I guess, in that first year, 200 applications for 17 associates. What sort of mix of people, you know, where did they come from? What did they, you know, what was their motivation, do you think?
It was really interesting to see the range of applicants we got actually for public practice, ranging in terms of ages. So we definitely got quite a lot of people in their sort of early 30s who have, you know, have that sort of five-ish years of experience. Yeah. And we basically have said you need at least 3 years of experience because, you know, going into local authorities where you might be the only person who has a particular type of skill, which is what a lot of our associates do have, it can, you need that sort of confidence to be able to push through and sort of lead projects. So that was definitely a kind of, we got lots of applicants around that age, but we also had lots of applicants in the sort of in the 50s and 60s, actually, people who had, interestingly, we have Kathy McEwen, who worked for a number of years in local authorities, but then worked at CAPE. And then this is almost a way for her to move back into public sector after all of these years. And other people have showed interest as well, people close to retiring and thinking, you know, we've been working in private sector, been doing these luxury flats for the last 25 years, and hold on, want to do something back. Exactly. So it's kind of a different way of working.
And I mean, how then do you go from 200 to 17?
We have a really interesting kind of process of shortlisting. We try and use new technologies and technologies that sort of support fairness. So the first round, actually, we invited, there's about 30 of us assessors, and all the applicants had to answer for really simple questions. But sometimes the simpler questions are the hardest to respond to. And the assessors basically had a random mix of answers. So we never knew who the person was to make it really, really fair in terms of not having unconscious bias. Yeah. So from that, basically, we got the sort of top, I think it was about 50 shortlisted applicants that we then invited for 2 days where we had a whole mixture of asks of the associates. So really quick fire presentations to doing group workshops. And the sort of things we're looking for, I mean, it's partly obviously getting the right experience and skills for particular jobs for local authorities, but there's also things around, you know, personality and the, you know, curating a cohort as well. And, you know, we're really keen that people are humble. I think if you work in local authority, there's something about understanding that actually people have been here for numbers of years and are actually really brilliant. And they also had this wanted to do public good, and maybe some of them along the way are tired. But a lot of them had that original agenda. So you know, that kind of classic architect, oh, I know best and I'm going to go into Hounslow and tell them what to do. Yeah. That's really, it might be right for a particular type of opportunity, but in the most part, actually, it's about working with different people.
That kind of emotional intelligence.
Completely. So there's a whole mixture of things we're looking for. And then it's about sort of match making the kind of opportunities and the people and kind of making sure it all works. And, you know, we're a young social enterprise. We're learning as we go. And we've already, from feedback from the associates who did it the first time round, they were like, oh my God, that was terrible. So we are learning from them and have shifted the way we're going to do it this time round. And also it's, you know, we ask local authorities to also put in expressions of interest. So it's really important that even the local authorities are applying and not just filling a gap in their jobs, but actually making sure that for us it's about
you're not being a recruitment service
exactly
for
absolutely different. So it's kind of fundamentally rethinking the way we work. So there's questions around additionality about are these roles cross-cutting, so would this job actually be across two or three teams, or is it two teams, or so it's, you know, or is it a place-based role where you're looking at a particular area and really focusing on that for that year. So it's kind of seeing that, like, how much appetite the local authority has, and around the research as well, because that becomes a really interesting opportunity for local authorities to feed into and develop.
You've obviously then got, you know, with the kind of number of applications coming in, interesting people applying, presumably a lot of your work then is actually going out to local authorities and boroughs and talking to them about why they should take in an associate.
So it's definitely a two-way thing, and you know, local authorities want people and we can help them find the right people, basically. So it's a really interesting sort of two-way relationship, and also, you know, speaking to local authorities, understanding what their biggest needs are. And this year compared to last year, you know, politically there's so much more, you know, as I mentioned before, opportunities for direct delivery. You know, we're seeing a change in how funding is working nationally, which is really good news. Different local authorities are doing it in different ways, so they're actually asking for different skills. While last year there had been quite a big focus from the London Plan and the NPPF around design. So I think the first cohort had, you know, over 50% architects. And I think that design is still one of the biggest skills that local authorities are asking for. But we're also seeing asks around kind of delivery and housing, which is really interesting. Yeah.
And that, I mean, that kind of question about skills then, and skills that are needed in particular places. I mean, it's kind of interesting, the work you're doing in public practice is not the sort of work one would imagine that is taught in architecture schools.
Completely. You know, I mean, well, yes and no. When I studied architecture, this sort of goes...
And jumping back, so you studied, you did a BA in architecture in Cambridge.
Yes.
I
studied architecture BA in Cambridge and then took a couple of years out and worked in multiple places, and I can come back to that. And then did my master's at the Bartlett. And all through my education, I was always trying to, like, not design buildings. and I think that's shifted now. I think there's lots of really interesting studios across architecture schools that are sort of overlapping urbanism and cities, like thinking about designing master plans and neighborhoods and seeing architecture as an agency. And of course, I really love designing buildings too, but it was also thinking about the kind of bigger impact they can have. So that sort of architecture and planning, and that being kind of seen as two completely different disciplines, I think is incredibly problematic. And you see that today with how there's so much, I wouldn't say hatred is quite the right word, but there's quite a
animosity
lot of animosity, and suspicion from both sides of the planning industry and the architecture industry. And architects see the planners as being kind of reductive and planners see the architects as dreamers. And actually, we're all trying to do the same thing. And planners actually create opportunities. They don't stop opportunities. You know, without planning, we wouldn't have cities in the first place. We wouldn't be able to kind of create these places in a way that actually is thoughtful and thought about in the kind of longer term as well.
And do you think then, I guess a lot of the work with boroughs is looking at kind of changing the model of how boroughs work and the skills that they get. Do you think there's a problem with a kind of architectural education in terms of, you know, you'll be taught planning, you'll be taught
completely. I mean,
and you won't.
Really, it's like the planners were on a different floor when I was studying my architecture, and it was a joke, you know. It was like, oh, they're the planner, you know. Yeah. And I look back now and I think I really wish someone had told me to go and talk to the planners, because that's really what clearly I was trying to do. I was trying to design neighbourhoods, and I was sort of always kind of brought back. But that's not true with all studios and all schools. And I think things have shifted and things are shifting, but there is much more we can do around trying to think of architecture and urbanism and planning as more multi and engineering as well, actually. Yeah. I think for me, it's about the built environment and how we can be more multidisciplinary and think about these things in a broader sense rather than it being so siloed. And that is reflected in the way the world works in terms of having architects and planners and even within local authorities, you see over the years, there's been a siloing of development management, so DM, there's kind of the housing team, there's the regen team, there's the planning team. I work in regen, and I'm sure some planners look at me and they're like, she's not really a planner, is she? Architects look at me and say, she's not really an architect, but you know, I'm used to that. Yeah. I moved country. I don't really fit in anywhere. So I think that's a positive. I think that kind of multidisciplinary aspect is something we should encourage and celebrate rather than be very precious about our professions.
Well, that reminds us, we probably need to get a educator on the program. I think I'm quite interested in hearing about changing architecture schools.
Actually, interestingly, this year I think Central St Martin's are the master's course is particularly really trying to push the boundary between what architecture is and what architects can do as an agency. So I'm actually running 3 workshops as a guest tutor this year, and it's all about kind of policy, land ownership, stakeholder management, delivery, funding, and getting students at that point to think about the realities of architecture and practice. And I think CSM are trying to do that, but there's a number of different studios across the UK that are really pushing these boundaries, and I think it should be kind of encouraged more, really.
I'll get some names after and we'll try and get them on.
Absolutely.
So you said that about kind of maybe being an outsider and about kind of taking on those different roles. I mean, jumping right back then to India, you were born in this country?
Born in America, in the US of A.
Okay.
So I've got a fairly strange route. So I was born in America and I lived there in Ohio. I haven't been back, so I don't really have any affiliation with Ohio. But my parents were living and working there at the time. And then we moved what was meant to be temporarily back to India. Well, my parents are from India, born bred. And they were there sort of studying for a short period of time. We basically ended up living in Mumbai, in Bombay, from 3 to 16. And that was very much
a kind of formative period.
It's still, I call that it's home. I go back every year. And my parents are still living there. And, my extended family, my school friends are there. So
when you talk about home, that's what you talk about.
I guess it's now a bit torn. I've been here sort of half my life now. So it's sort of somewhere in between. I'm at that threshold where I've been every day now here. I've been here longer than I've been in Bombay, so it's getting more complicated. But yes, I think there is something about being an outsider makes me look at British cities and towns in a slightly more detached way. And even the planning system or architecture or places, I sort of don't have that nostalgia.
Yeah.
And even around this kind of 70s architecture, which a lot of my colleagues, you know, in the public sector have that kind of nostalgia for, I didn't really grow up with that. Yeah. So I find it kind of more academic and interesting, and have a kind of slightly more detached relationship with it, which I think is quite interesting. It brings a different
kind of perspective.
Absolutely. And makes me also quite aware of different ways people live. And that's something I'm really interested in, you know, somewhere, well, my role at the GLA, you know, working for London, being aware of how multicultural our city is, and perhaps sometimes forgetting that people fundamentally live in quite different ways. So when we're thinking about how many homes we should design, sometimes it's a question of, actually, an Indian family probably would live in this home quite a different way than a Jewish family would.
Yeah.
And are we thinking about that when we're thinking about homes? And it can be quite a controversial conversation to have, but it's something I'm really interested in.
And then 16, you say the move from Mumbai to straight to London, was it?
Straight to London. I studied and boarded for 2 years in a school in London and then went to Cambridge. And I guess for my family, it's always like education has always been the kind of biggest priority, and all sacrifices have been made to for my parents to afford to send me abroad initially. And you know, I've been here ever since, really, more or less. Mm-hmm. And it was, I guess it was a bit of a cultural shock at the time. But when I look back now, I think of how big the cultural shock was. Or maybe I'm getting more of a cultural shock at this age than I did at 16. Because when you're younger,
pretty flexible,
you're quite flexible and you don't sort of notice elements of racism, I think, as you do when you're older. So I think as I'm aging, I might be getting more sensitive or more acutely aware of the sort of immigrant status.
It's hard to know whether things are getting worse or whether we notice more, and whether
I think it's probably a bit of both.
Yeah.
I think things are more acute at the moment. We're all, it's very live. People are talking about these things more. Yeah, it's a hard one.
I hope we'll be talking about them more with our theme for next year of boundaries and of, identity last year for the festival, and kind of some of those issues might come up then.
No, absolutely.
And so a couple of years at boarding school here, when did the kind of gem of an idea of studying architecture at university, when did that start? Parents aren't architects.
No, they're not. My sister's actually an engineer. And so it's somewhere in our blood.
Yeah.
I guess we grew up playing a lot of blocks. And I think I used to make the city and she would make the tower, funnily enough. So clearly it was all there, age four. But I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. An architect, I actually wrote, I can't even remember what you call it anymore, your application for university to go to art school, which in retrospect is, you cannot imagine me in art school. But then architecture, I kind of studied both the sciences and the arts, and it felt, and I think that's who I am. I really love lots of different things. I'm really interested in lots of different things, and that's reflected in what I do today, actually.
Yeah.
So architecture in the kind of British system felt like it was actually quite a multidisciplinary way of education, and especially at Cambridge. It had a really interesting kind of history and theory course, but also was really hands-on in studio, but also had the kind of structural, environmental kind of approach. So I think that it was the kind of multidisciplinary opportunity that sort of attracted me to architecture. At the time, absolutely. And I really enjoyed it. And I know I grew as a person massively at my time there. And a lot of my kind of closest ties or friendships and architects that have come from that generation, and they're all doing
interesting work in different places.
Absolutely, they're all doing really brilliant things today, and so it was a really interesting kind of, and the social agenda was always very strong at Cambridge, and me kind of thinking about who you're building for, what is the kind of context of what is around. So it was really, it sort of bode really well for me.
And then kind of fairly quickly to a number of kind of quite interesting firms, not quite delivering what you might think of as typical kind of architecture firms.
Yeah, you've done your research.
Publica and We Made That.
Both but actually before Publica and We Made That, the first job I took was for Ilse Crawford, who's a designer. Yeah. And again, it was the kind of multidisciplinary nature that attracted me to her design. And at the time, I guess I was designing kind of small sort of boutique-y hotels in a way.
And she's doing a number of amazing airport lounges for airlines.
Yeah, and that's
things.
Kind of what she's doing now. And but what was really interesting, what is really interesting about Ilse is that you, it's before, I guess, branding became a kind of buzzword. She would take an entire space and think about it from the design of an illustration on a plate, if you're doing a restaurant, to designing who the chef is. So it was this kind of holistic approach to a space with a human
kind of brand identity.
Yeah, with the human-centered approach, which I don't know, in 2007 was pretty radical, I think.
Yeah.
So she was really, really interesting person to work for, and I learned a lot. But the kind of private aspect of that always, I knew, was a bit limiting, and I always wanted to design or create places that anyone could.
A wider audience.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So from there, I actually moved to New York for a year.
Okay.
And I worked for a small practice called Gordon Kipping Architects, or GTECs. And that was literally when recession hit, and I was going to be working on a number of sort of cultural projects in Harlem. And a lot of these things sort of fell through. So that year was a really interesting year of like doing lots of competitions, but being in New York and actually
whilst the kind of bottom fell out of the market.
Completely. Yeah. So I was like at the heart of it. And that's when Obama got elected. Yeah. I was in Brooklyn on the street.
Yeah.
It was really fun.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a kind of whole... I was
Again,
sort of
kind of formative political times, really interesting politics.
Yeah, completely. And it was a really interesting time to be in New York in itself.
Yeah.
I think the architecture in New York is probably, I kind of realized actually the British scene was more interesting and more, and the European scene actually had more kind of pushing boundaries a bit more. But at the time, I also started to do more public projects for Newark Council. And so again, I was sort of like working within these worlds of public projects, cultural projects, schools. And then I came back to London, and again, that was a time when you could sort of take a year out and do multiple projects. So I worked at Publica part-time. And again, this was not like obviously architecture, but I was actually Lucy Musgrave's first employee at Publica. And now, you know, they're absolutely, they're brilliant and so successful. And she, I mean, she's one of my role models and completely inspiring women. And again, really rethinking how you understand places and cities. So I worked at Publica part-time. I actually did a little installation for the London Festival of Architecture that year. I designed a little tricycle with my partner. And again, this was pre-pop-up tea shops, so I'd like to kind of take some credit for that.
Setting a trend.
Yeah, absolutely. And we cycled around Bermondsey to Stratford serving chai.
Okay.
And kind of, again, before meanwhile spaces, just kind of setting up in an arch and serving tea for a few weeks.
Wow.
So didn't pay that well, but you know.
Kept the wolf from the door.
And worked for a furniture designer for a bit. So I guess I was always just trying to test, like.
And did you have a kind of a vision then of where you were going or what you wanted to do? Or were you just, I'll do this job for a while and I'll see if I like it.
Yeah,
or what
it's
was
so
the kind
hard.
Of...
I mean, it's when you look back, it just seems like so obvious your path, like, that you where you are. But it wasn't that clear. I knew I wanted to do public work and work that was beyond designing the fabric of buildings.
Yeah.
So that was the kind of criteria.
Okay. And then doing your master's, the Bartlett, and then we made that another kind of... interesting.
Exactly. So
company.
I think
tell us a bit about
completely. Yeah. I think I have this this habit of joining practices when there's sort of two or three people and then leaving just as about about like
the big
because
time.
Yeah, exactly. So
my work here is done.
So I joined We Made That just after university. my master's, and that was just like 2012, I guess. It was when the Olympics was on and there was opportunities for smaller practices to do kind of projects and in the public sector and kind of somewhere between like art installations, architecture, public work. And we made that only work for public clients. Yeah. And that was really, really attractive to me. And at the time we were quite small, and therefore there was an opportunity to really like drive a project and sort of influence it. So over the few years, I was there for about 3 years, and one of my pet projects was Black Horse Lane regeneration.
Yeah.
So that was a project in Walthamstow, and again around 2012 when no one went, well, when I say no one, that's not true. Black Horse Lane wasn't on the kind of map as it was in inverted commas today. And it was really, really interesting. That was my sort of getting into the insight of how public sector works. And, you know, people quite easily just think, oh, look, Black Horse Lane has, you know, just happened. And you're like, no, someone has been thinking about this for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
It doesn't just happen overnight. And the graph of change is steep, but the, you know, it's like, it's quite slow in the beginning.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of thinking.
That kind of opposite of a long tail, really, isn't it? The kind of long slope up, and
exactly.
then suddenly changes really quick.
And it, and it's that kind of period of the slow change, which I find really interesting, and seeing how Walthamstow had an idea that this was an interesting, important area, the Walthamstow Town Centre and Black Horse Lane. But Black Horse Lane was quite industrial, and there was a kind of bigger conversation happening at the GLA about industrial land and how can you make industrial areas attractive for homeowners, for residents, and how do you kind of bridge this gap between the two. So that was what Black Horse Lane was about, really. It's really interesting. There was kind of shop, the high street and shop fronts, there was industrial units, and there was homes that were going to come in 5 years.
Yeah.
So what interventions can you do in those 5 years to make Black Horse Lane an interesting place, but also to make sure that existing businesses are prepared for that change.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of soft kind of work you do of talking to shopkeepers, telling them change is coming, kind of, you know, building up skills, and also starting to kind of work with the different organizations and makers that were already on Black Horse Lane. It was about seeding it. It was, you know, Black Horse Lane workshop didn't just happen to come there, you know, it was thought through as a really important place. So it was a really nice combination of strategic thinking of the neighborhood and the place of Black Horse Lane, and then also delivering physical improvements of wayfinding signs and shopfront improvements, which is what I qualified, I did my part three on, really.
Right, okay. And that kind of north, where are we kind of, I mean, your patch of London, I guess, for the GLA is north.
West,
Northwest
actually.
London. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
So I'm actually,
okay.
Yeah, I'm on the other side now.
Okay.
And
work your way around slowly.
it's so interesting because you get to see places in London that you wouldn't necessarily go to, and you realise you have certain perceptions of areas, but actually, you know, and I guess Grenfell is an interesting it's sort of in our minds now, but you know, in your mind you think, oh, Hammersmith and Fulham, you know, it's an incredibly rich area, but when you start walking around, you actually realise actually there's massive inequality in central London in a way that is not really obvious. So you need to rethink your own preconceived ideas of places and really think about what intervention is needed to bridge that inequality.
So we talked, I mean, a little bit then about kind of public practice, but public practice is your kind of evening job, and you're kind of, you're still working at the GLA. Just maybe tell us a little bit about some of the work kind of at the GLA. And the...
Sure. So I work both on, continue to work on public practice. It spun out like a year ago, as we said.
Okay.
So I continue to be really involved with it. But my sort of day-to-day job is working in the Northwest area. So I work with Brent, Hammersmith and Fulham and Ealing, and the Old Oak Park Royal Development Corporation, which basically encompasses these three boroughs. And they have their own team and work independently. And what I've been doing over the last few years is thinking about the boundary of the Old Oak and Park Royal Development Corporation, OPDC.
Yeah.
We all love some short terms. So thinking about actually when all this money is being invested in this area, what happens at the boundary, what happens to the town centre that's just outside the the Old Oak region. So one of the areas I've been looking into is Harlesden in Brent. So working with Brent Council, thinking about how can you prepare for what might happen in the next 2, 5, 10 years in terms of the change that's going to happen. Yeah. So we kind of work with Brent and the OBDC to, you know, it's a really interesting job. So it's partly about sort of negotiation and like that's a kind of political sense of getting the right people to talk to each other. And that's slow, it takes time. Yeah. So that's kind of one of the things we do. But then you get to a point where we're like, actually, we all agree that we want to work on this together. And then it's about sort of creating the policy, creating the right frameworks, thinking.
So, I mean, some of it then is, I mean, what you might call kind of stakeholder management and kind of setting up conversations.
Completely. And a lot of it is behind the scenes. Yeah.
And not, you know, designing buildings or designing space between buildings. Again, it's an interesting kind of...
Yeah, but it's not that different because as an architect, a lot of what you do is really making sure the client is making decisions. Yeah. The decision-making is 90% of the work you're doing, you know, especially if you're designing homes, you're working with if you're working with a couple, it's so much of that is relationship management.
About being a marriage guidance
counselor. Completely,
and this
actually
is that on a bigger scale.
Yeah, the design ends up taking that little time, and I'm still, you know, I'm still part of help writing the briefs.
Yeah.
That's sort of already setting what the design work is going to be. Yeah. Help choose the right design and the consultants. And then over time, you are really influential in, it's almost like design reviews. You're constantly saying, oh, have you thought about this? Have you thought about this? Yeah. So I'm not drawing on CAD anymore, but I'm making sure the architects are drawing the right things on CAD. But one of my pet projects has been the Granville in South Kilburn. And that was a really it was like a interesting political project where there's been this building that's primarily been empty for a few years. Some community groups are using parts of the building. South Kilburn Trust is a brilliant charity that's been working in the area. And Brent were thinking, oh, let's do something with this building. So over time, it's again about getting everyone on board. Everyone wants different things and everyone has different agendas. So we've ended up with this brilliant mixed-use building which has artist studios but also has community space that the South Kilburn Trust is overseeing. RCKA Architects designed it. And, you know, through the process, a lot of what I do is, you know, behind the scenes, but you kind of curate and manage these things to sort of happen. And, you know, I know RCKA, and there was other brilliant architects who applied for the job, but, you know, you have, having an architecture background, you know the importance of good design. So I always make sure that there's good consultants on board because actually that's where the magic happens. So I think it's really important, my kind of architecture background in kind of creating these really brilliant projects.
That's fantastic. Really nice. I was really fascinated at kind of what architects do and the breadth, you know, the people we speak to, the kind of range of things that people with an architecture background are doing as their day to day. It's a real kind of education for everything, really.
I really think that's a positive thing. Yeah. I think alternative careers in architecture will really help the diversity issue of the profession. Yeah. So there's so many people I know who studied architecture, photographers, they're engineers, they're sustainability consultants, they're planners. Mm-hmm. They're educators, they are set designers. And somehow I feel like through university, there's almost a stigma against the idea of doing something different.
Yeah.
And you know, through university, success was seen as setting up Pooja Agrawal Architects. And I think we need to move away from that narrative because I really push for diversity in our profession. And one of the issues people have from lower socioeconomic backgrounds or from BAME backgrounds is that it's a really long course and that you're not going to get paid well at the end of it. And it's like, well, why don't you do it for 3 years, see if you want to be an architect, but actually there's lots of other things you can do with this education. Yeah. And I think as a profession, we should really encourage alternative careers rather than really be sort of quite possessive about the title architect.
Yeah. Fantastic. There's just a couple of other kind of little things I'm kind of tend to finish with. I'm quite interested in just, I guess I'm always interested in optimism versus pessimism and kind of your take on, I mean, we're a festival about London and about kind of Londoners and just about experiencing things and seeing things where people should go and places that inspire you in London. I'm really, so it's really rambling. It's about 12 questions in that.
Yeah.
I mean, things that inspire, yeah, I mean, places that you, I mean, I guess that kind of find interesting in London from that, people you think other places can learn from, those kind of public spaces.
I think I'm really interested in neighbourhoods and going to places I don't really know very well, and I think my job enables me to do that.
Yeah.
And actually just taking the tube on a Saturday and just going to Harlesden, going to Acton, or going to, I don't know, I'm thinking Northwest London because that's where I spend all my
that's
time.
That's where people should go.
But,
yeah,
you know, going to places that you have no reason to go to and understanding the different dimensions of London is really interesting. Through public practice as well, we have associates across the southeast, and every other Friday we go to different local authorities, so because different associates host them, and I had never really been to Bexley before, and hadn't really been to Havering or Hounslow, or have but haven't thought about it as being Havering or Hounslow. So I think we should all do more to sort of just experience different neighbourhoods and places, and going to a builder's calf or a local Ghanaian calf and just understanding how people live differently within this city, I think, is really important.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Pooja Agrawal. You can find out more about Pooja and public practice at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. If you've enjoyed the programme, why not leave a review or a rating with your podcast provider, as this will help others to discover the programme. You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.